Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, you might be looking for ways to stay fit and active, but if you find yourself frequently running because of a sudden urge to go to the bathroom, it might be time to talk to a urologist. And we have one for you today, Dr. Michael Guralnick, back with us once again. He's a professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and we'll talk with him about how often you should or shouldn't be going to the bathroom, and we'll look at strategies to stay hydrated. After all, today is National Hydration Day. So as we move along, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you're having trouble making it through work meetings without excusing yourself to go to the bathroom. Maybe you're getting up too many times in the middle of the night, concerned about what might be causing your overactive bladder. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Michael Guralnick, welcome back. Thanks for joining in again.
Thanks for having me.
Can you explain how communication between the bladder and the brain works?
How much time do we have?
Well, I'm thinking about driving along on the interstate, and I'm not thinking at all about going to the bathroom, but then I'll see a sign for a restroom, and then suddenly I'll think I have to go.
Yeah, you're not alone. That the other common triggers are even just getting out of the car or getting to your home and putting the key in the door, or just walking by a bathroom, or even, you know, putting your hand under the tap water. All notorious triggers to stimulate the bladder. Almost like a Pavlovian response.
Yeah,
and there's incredible communication between the brain and the central nervous system and the bladder, probably more complex than even the regulation of the heart, and that's where a lot of the focus of current research is in dealing with nuisance bladder issues.
Yeah, how do we know when it's time to go to the bathroom?
Well, normally your bladder fills up with urine, and there are certain nerve receptors in the bladder that start to send signals to the brain as the bladder is starting to fill up. They have these receptors that get stretched, and then that triggers the receptors to send signals to the nervous system through the spinal cord, and then it gets processed in the brain, and then the brain sends signals back to the bladder, usually telling the bladder to stay quiet. So there's these inhibitory signals, and that's why generally you don't wet yourself. In patients who have overactive bladder issues, sometimes these signals don't work properly, and so the brain isn't able to inhibit the bladder properly, and then these patients have to suddenly go urgently and maybe even not make it to the bathroom in time. I liken it to a baby's bladder. You know, a baby doesn't have that regulation. It takes the maturation process to develop that. So the baby's bladder just fills up, and it sends signals that go to the spinal cord, and then there's an actual reflex that triggers the bladder to go. And then as the baby matures, then these regulatory processes start to develop and kick in.
Interesting. Is there an ideal number of times we should be going to the bathroom every day?
Some of my patients would love to only go once a day. You know, it's kind of arbitrary. The International Continence Society, which is this big international society of urologists, gynecologists, neurologists, arbitrarily has defined urinating up to 8 times in 24 hours as being a normal urinary frequency. The problem with that is it doesn't factor in how much urine is actually being produced. If somebody is producing a tremendous amount of urine, you would expect them to have to go more frequently. And so just selecting an arbitrary number, it doesn't really work well unless you also factor in how much urine is being produced.
Is it, you know, you've heard this, the old adage, never pass up a chance to go to the bathroom, but is it possible to take too many bathroom breaks, and can that lead to problems?
Well, for some people, yeah, you know, the bladder is a creature of habit that can be trained both positively and negatively, and so if you get in a habit of you know, often going, you know, just because you're about to leave the house, or, you know, some people go right before meals, which, you know, at the time seems totally appropriate. The bladder kind of, you know, takes notice of this, and it'll actually start to, not necessarily misbehave is the right word, but it'll get so used to doing that, that when you start to do the activity that would normally lead you to go to the bathroom, whereas previously you wouldn't necessarily have the sensation of needing to go, now the bladder's actually telling you it wants to go because it's so used to doing that. And that's the concern. If you get into that habit of routinely doing things, that your bladder might take note and start to become a habit of its own. And that's what we have to actually try to break the habit of.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about my own bladder all that often. But, you know, I'm on the air. I'm in the studio for an hour before the show, and then I'm on the air for 2 hours. And typically when I'm done with the show, I may go to, you know, I'll feel, oh, okay, I've got to go to the bathroom. But if I get back to my office and then I start doing some other things right away, I realize I really didn't have to go.
Exactly. The brain can easily be distracted, and then the bladder kind of minds its own business.
Oh, man. Dan in Janesville has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Dan, hi. Sure. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hello, doctor. I have a question. Hello, Larry.
Yeah. Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Okay. So, anyway, I have a problem I think is kind of interesting. Problem and sort of went away, I guess. For about a year, I had a burning sensation in my bladder all the time. Nothing terrible, but I could sense that it was there. Went to the doctor, had an MRI with contrast exam. Nothing unusual. Couldn't figure out what it was. A little bit of hematuria, which I've had for years. And I've been taking melatonin for years, every night, 5 milligrams. I decided to stop taking it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, you know, because I got tired of taking something every night. I'm going to learn how to go to sleep early without it. And within a week, that bladder burning sensation went away.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's any irritants that may have been in that melatonin or byproduct in it, inert ingredient, that might have caused that.
You know, I can't say specifically what one, but it sure sounds like it. I've not heard of melatonin itself being an irritant to the bladder, but I suppose it's possible there was some other ingredient in the capsule that might have been an irritant. And the fact that by stopping it, your sensation went away, it's hard to ignore that. I suppose if you really wanted to test the hypothesis, you start taking that melatonin again, and if the symptom comes back, and then you stop it and the symptom goes away, then you've pretty much proved that there was some ingredient in that pill or tablet.
Yeah.
I can't specify which one.
That's interesting, Dan. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You might try that experiment, or maybe you don't want to experiment.
Right.
This might be a one-shot case study here that we're talking about with Dan anyway. And by the way, you can join in too. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Can you explain the damage that straining to go to the bathroom can cause?
Well, you know, some people have to strain for various reasons. In some cases, it's because there's an actual obstruction to the flow of urine, you know, and the classic one for that is a middle-aged or elderly male with a prostate enlargement that's literally compressing or squeezing the passageway, and it's restricting the flow, and so they end up straining to supplement the bladder's ability. You know, the bladder itself has muscle that squeezes to push the urine out, but in the face of an obstruction, they'll sometimes sometimes have to strain to augment that ability. And, you know, that's actually not that uncommon, and often treatments for the prostate issue will improve that matter. But the concern when one does strain a lot is it's not so much that it's going to injure the bladder per se, but you might develop other things. So, you know, that's actually one of the common causes of a hernia. So men who have groin hernias, the classic story is they end up getting their hernia repair, and then postoperatively they can't urinate, and they have what's called urinary retention. And it's thought that the anesthesia from the surgery sort of tips them over the edge, but what it leads to is an uncovering of an underlying prostate issue that went ignored, and the hernia, the development of the hernia and then the subsequent treatment finally brought it to light. In women, you can develop a hernia in the groin, but you can also develop what's called vaginal prolapse, where various pelvic structures such as the bladder or the uterus or the rectum actually start to herniate into the vagina, and they actually develop a bulge that sometimes can protrude, and difficulties urinating with excessive straining is one of the risk factors for that as well. So, you know, the urinary tract itself can probably tolerate some degree of straining, but other structures in the body may not like it so much. And so, you know, if you can avoid straining, that's always better. Now, some people will strain to urinate simply because they really don't need to go and they're trying to force it. And again, that's part of a behavior issue where, you know, sometimes they're doing it because they want to preemptively try to empty their bladders for various reasons. And then in order to do so, because they actually don't have a feeling of needing to go, they're straining really hard to get the urine out. And again, that can lead to some of those problems that ideally you want to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Stephen in Stevens Point has something. Let's go there. Hi, Stephen.
Oh, hello. I was wondering if the doctor could allude to the advantages and disadvantages of the various methods of treating prostate cancer, such as surgery, radiation, chemotherapy.
I'd love to. I'm actually not an expert in prostate cancer. I treat more voiding dysfunctions, which are non-cancer issues. That's probably a subject that's appropriate for a different show, because that's a whole show in and of itself. And there are pros and cons to each, but I'm not sure it's really relevant as far as today's topic goes.
Steve, thank you for calling. Helen in Wabasha, we'll go to you next. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually have a brief comment and a question. My comment was regarding the gentleman who called in about melatonin.
Yeah.
I also have problems with melatonin. They don't display in quite the same way for me. Melatonin causes diarrhea. So I think different people react pretty differently to, you know, some people have no reactions, but I definitely do. So I just wanted to mention that. But my real question is, I have urinary incontinence and I've tried a variety of medications. And I'm wondering what this gentleman thinks about Botox injections for urinary incontinence.
Well, so the first question is what type of urinary incontinence you have. There's generally two different types, and they're treated completely differently, at least when one gets to aggressive treatments. So one type of incontinence is when you get a sudden feeling of needing to urinate, and then you can't get to the bathroom in time, and that's called urgency incontinence because it's associated with a strong urge to urinate. And that's the type of incontinence that one often will take medications and even consider something like Botox for, and that's basically what we call an overactive bladder. The other type of incontinence is incontinence that occurs with exercise or coughing or sneezing, anything that causes you to tighten up your tummy muscles. And often you don't even have a feeling of needing to urinate at the time, because in truth, that's not a bladder problem. That's a problem with the urethral sphincter, which are the brakes in the system that you would use to stop your flow when you're trying to pass your urine. And that's the type of incontinence that some women will experience after childbirth. But those are actually two different issues. So depending on which one you're experiencing, and some women, they'll actually experience both. Something like Botox is only useful for the urgency incontinence. And so if one does have that urgency incontinence, Botox is actually a very good treatment for it. It unfortunately requires a procedure to do, but it's a pretty minor procedure, just a scope. Often can be done under a local anesthetic. Doesn't last, which is another one of its downsides, because the Botox effect tends to wear off in about 6 months, but one can always repeat it. And it carries with a couple of small risks. One, you can develop a urinary infection related to the procedure. And then the biggest fear, but it's a pretty low risk, especially when you use a low dose of Botox, is that sometimes the Botox can work too well and actually weaken the bladder too much to the point that it becomes difficult to pass the urine. And some people can actually end up having to deal with a catheter temporarily to empty their bladder if the Botox kind of shut down the bladder too often. So depending on what type of incontinence you have, Botox may or may not be appropriate.
Helen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Michael Goralnik, our guest today, it's great to have him with us, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Always good to have him come by as we talk with him today. You can join in as well. The number 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today here on WPR News as we talk about the secrets to bladder health with our guest today, Dr. Michael Goralnik, great to have him back as well, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We'll take another call. Robin in St. Paul, Minnesota, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for the show. I am curious on the role of hormone replacement therapy for menopausal, postmenopausal women in pelvic health, as well as bladder health. Has there been research studies? I'm hearing a lot about estrogen replacement, estradiol, et cetera. What you would say about that.
All right.
Sure. A great question. This is actually a hot topic nowadays. Estrogen is involved in keeping the vaginal and urogenital tissues robust and healthy. And when one goes through menopause, the body stops producing estrogen, and that can lead to tissue changes both in the vagina and in the urinary tract, what we call atrophy, where the tissues become kind of brittle, a little more irritable, and that can definitely have some adverse effects for women. And so I'm actually a huge proponent of estrogen replacement therapy, but I only use it in the context of topical application into the vagina, and not, you know, a systemic application such as using a pill or a patch, which there are some benefits to that as well. But as far as improving the urinary tract and vaginal health, I think when it's applied locally, that's when it's going to have its best effect and be the safest. And it has benefits both as far as bladder irritability and sensitivity goes. Some people who are lacking the estrogen and developing this atrophy can find their bladders more irritated. In some cases, it can even be a burning sensation in the pelvic region. In many cases, they can be more prone to urinary tract infections. And when you give back the estrogen in the form of a cream or even a vaginal suppository, it doesn't work immediately, but gradually over time, they'll often see an improvement in those kind of irritative symptoms. They can see major benefits as far as a reduction in the frequency of their urinary infections, and even an improvement in some of their nuisance bladder symptoms. And the big fear has always been that when you give the estrogen back, are you going to start to trigger, you know, malignancy in the breast or in the gynecologic organs, but most of the current research and review studies have actually come to the conclusion that vaginal estrogen replacement is actually very safe, and all these concerns about triggering cancer were probably overblown. And the recommendations is, if you're having these symptoms, you should definitely consider using it.
Yeah, Robin, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Robert in Superior next. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I just was listening to your program, and I wanted to share with you my situation. Just coming up on a year now, I've been involved in a clinical study called Proverum. It is a device that's implanted in the urethra in the prostate. It's like a spring, like a stent. And I wonder if the doctor knows about that.
Not that particular one. No, I'm going to actually have to go look at it. That it's not the first time that they've tried using urethral stents and things as an alternative to the old-fashioned prostate surgery. How's it been going for you?
It's going very well. It took a while. It was pretty traumatic when it happened, but after about 6 or 8 weeks, it really mellowed out and seemed to have worked well. I'm just in a couple of weeks going in for the 1 year checkup when they'll actually go in with a scope and look at it.
What your symptoms leading to this were, was it difficulties urinating or difficulties holding the urine or both?
No, just difficulty urinating and doing it many times in the night.
Sure. And so the insert tries to spread apart the tissues of the inside of the prostate to widen the urethra and widen the channel so that it's easier to pass the urine.
Yeah. Interesting. Robert, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Bob in Kakana. Your turn. Hi, Bob.
Well, hi. I have a situation right now where I have to urinate frequently, and I have somewhat of an enlarged prostate, and they tried me on different drugs. I'm currently on one called Mibetric, which is very expensive, and it seems to keep me from waking up 4 times a night to go to the bathroom. But I've had 2 friends who've had surgery. One had TURP, and the other had like an aquablation, and they're very happy with the results. And I don't know whether I should continue on a drug or encourage to go to the operation. What are your thoughts on that?
Great question. So to clarify, the medicine you're actually on is not a prostate medicine. Mirbetric, or otherwise known as mirabegron, is actually an overactive bladder drug that targets the bladder, not the prostate. And what it does is it tries to help relax the bladder, because sometimes people will urinate often because the bladder itself is misbehaving and making you need to pass your urine, even though maybe the bladder isn't all that full. And that's actually what an overactive bladder is. In men, the question is whether the bladder is overactive because of a blockage from the prostate. So the operations that you described, the TURP or transurethral resection of the prostate or the aqua ablation, are both different ways of scraping out basically some of the prostate tissue from the inside to widen the passageway and remove a blockage to the flow. And then the theory is that by getting rid of said prostate blockage, the bladder can calm down because now it doesn't have to work so hard to push the urine past the blockage. And then that leads to a reduction in how often one urinates. So the big question in your case is, is your prostate really the underlying culprit, or might you actually just have an overactive bladder that's independent of the prostate, and then the medicine that's targeting the bladder is what's working for you, in which case then you might not want to consider prostate surgery. So the question to ask your urologist, assuming that that's who's been prescribing it for you, is how much do they actually think the prostate itself is the problem here? And in some cases, we'll resort to some specialized testing of the bladder and the prostate called urodynamic testing, where you can actually potentially prove that the prostate is causing a restriction to flow. And if you prove that, then you might consider the surgery if you're hoping to get off medication.
Yeah, there you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take another call. Perry in Wisconsin Rapids will go to you now. Thanks for calling, Perry. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm 74 years old, and I have an enlarged prostate. They said it was massive, but I'm having surgery in September. But my problem is, if I really have to pee bad, I can't go. So I'm in the habit of... And I drive truck, quad axle dump truck, so whenever I can get someplace, I'm going to the bathroom so I don't get that pressure. And I was just wondering if that's all I can do. And
yeah,
they tried to put me on some certain medications, but I had side effects and wound up in the emergency room. So I'm definitely not going on that.
Sure. Well, so it sounds like you said you're having the prostate surgery in a couple of months, and that definitely has the potential to help the symptoms that you're describing. In some cases, you know, the prostate, as I said, can restrict the flow, so you have that urge to urinate, and it's a struggle to get the urine to come out, and doing the prostate surgery can definitely help with that. And so what can you do in the meantime? Well, it's probably put up with things and do what you're currently doing until you get to said surgery.
Yeah, there you go, Perry. Thank you very much for calling. And we have some open lines. Finally, I can get you in pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could shoot an email to talk@wpr.org. Had a question about oxybutynin alternatives. Is mirbetric the best one? Is there a best way to get off oxybutynin and switch to an alternative? We didn't have a name attached to this.
That's okay, but that's actually a great question. So these drugs, oxybutynin, mirbetric, there's another variety of ones called Vesicare, Gemtesa, these are all what we call overactive bladder drugs. And so they target the bladder to try to relax the hyperactive or overactive bladder muscle that's causing the bladder to have to go urgently and frequently. And oxybutynin and mirbetric are each in a different class. There's one class called anticholinergics, which is what oxybutynin is. The other class is called a beta adrenergic, and that's what mirbetric is. And they work completely different from each other. They target two different nerve receptors that trigger the bladder. Oxybutynin is probably the oldest, most well-known overactive bladder drug. As far as their ability to actually work on the bladder and relax it, they're pretty much equivalent. No study has ever confirmed one of these drugs to actually be superior to any of the other ones as far as their ability to improve the bladder. The issue has to do with their side effects. Mm-hmm. And drugs like oxybutynin, which are in the class of anticholinergic drugs, are notorious for side effects. The most common being dry mouth, second most common probably constipation, blurred vision. And with oxybutynin in particular, the biggest concern is that it can get into the brain and block the same nerve receptor in the brain that can actually lead to mental fogginess. And there's even some concerns about dementia-like effects with chronic use. So lots of people are actually trying to get off oxybutynin for that concern. And a drug like Myrbetriq is a great alternative because it doesn't generally carry those risks because it works through a different mechanism. Unfortunately, the biggest problem with all of this is the nature of the American medical system that seems to be run by insurance companies who dictate which medications they're willing to pay for. And oxybutynin is undoubtedly the cheapest of the bunch, which, and of course, it causes the most side effects, whereas drugs like Myrbetriq or its newest cousin called Gemtesa tend to be some of the most expensive because they're the newest ones and they cause the least amount of side effects. And so then it becomes a matter of trying to argue with the insurance company to get these covered. So ideally, I would love to put everybody on a drug like Myrbetriq or this new one called Gemtesa, but sometimes we don't have the luxury to be able to do so because the patient's insurance won't pay for it.
Mm. There's a related question here to in an email to oxybutynin. Janine from Fond du Lac takes oxybutynin once or twice a day for hyperhidrosis.
Sure.
She says she can last the entire day without urinating and wants to know if this is safe.
Well, I guess it depends on how much urine she's producing and how full her bladder is actually getting. Because, yes, that's one of the anticholinergic side effects of a drug like oxybutynin is that it can actually block your sweat glands. And so that's what leads to the improvement in excessive sweating. Now, you have to be careful with weather like we're having now because you need to be able to sweat for your body to cool down. And so actually one of the risks in people who take oxybutynin in weather like this is that they can actually overheat and be much more prone to heat stroke and stuff. But of course, you know, she's taking it for her sweating, but it's also going to have its effects on the bladder and even on the bowel. So it'll potentially contribute to constipation as well. So, you know, prolonged urine holding in and of itself is sometimes okay for some people and for other people, not so much. Some people are more prone to urinary infections if they try to hold their urine too long. So I think it really depends on whether she's experiencing any of issues like that. If she's not having any problems and is still urinating, then it's probably fine.
Mary in Green Bay will go to you. Hi, Mary. Mary, are you there? Well, I tell you what, I know what she wants to ask, and her advice. She wants advice on how much water to be drinking. How much water should we drink?
Great question. We normally tell people to drink so that you're not thirsty. You know, there's the old adage that you got to drink eight-ounce cups of water a day. So that's about 64 ounces. And that's great, but some people, you know, interpret that to mean they got to drink at least that, but then on top of all their other coffee, juice, milk, soda. And so then they're actually drinking, you know, closer to 100 ounces. So, you know, the average person probably consumes roughly 60 to 70 ounces of liquid a day, you know, roughly 2 liters of fluid. And that's a perfect amount unless you're sweating excessively, such as during weather like we're having, where it's probably recommended to up the fluid intake. Or if you're prone to form kidney stones, well, then you have to drink lots because you've got to keep your urine nice and dilute in order to prevent kidney stone formation. Or if you're having constipation issues, you want to make sure you're maintaining a good fluid intake, because to treat constipation, it's not just fiber. The fiber needs water with it to keep the stools bulky and soft. So there is no actual magic number as far as what's the right amount, but roughly around, you know, 60 to 70 ounces a day is very reasonable.
Virginia emailed a 70-year-old woman who, when she urinates, she thinks she's done, but when she stands up, she finds there might be some urine that drips down her leg. She wants to know if there's something she can do besides Kegel exercises, which she's been doing to help the issue.
Another very common concern for patients. Now, it really depends on whether she's actually emptying her bladder adequately or not. And that for that, you'd need to have what we call a post-void residual checked, where you can actually use either an ultrasound or a catheter to measure what's left in the bladder after one urinates. Because if it turns out there's actually a fair bit left behind, well, that's a whole separate issue versus, you know, if it's pretty well empty and it's a few extra drops, generally the Kegels would be the way to go. What I'll sometimes have patients do if we haven't found anything of concern and it's just a nuisance few drops that happens after they finish urinating is they do what we call double voiding, where, you know, they wipe themselves. And then before they stand up to pull up their clothes, they stand up a little bit, but then sit back down and see if they can get that last little bit out and then get up to pull up their clothes. If it's a true problem with emptying of the bladder, then sometimes we might use some medication to see if that facilitates things. The problem then becomes, especially in women, is that, you know, sometimes if you make it too easy to empty, then sometimes they can start having troubles holding in the urine because you've made it too easy for the urine to come out, and you have to try to find the right balance.
David from Shorewood emailed. He's 64 with BPH and a distended bladder with no ability to produce pressure per my urodynamic test. Two different urologists have made recommendations that are differing. One's promoting surgery, the other is not, just recommending monitoring. Wants to know the risks post-surgery if prostate is opened up.
So I'm presuming that they're referring to either the transurethral resection of the prostate, or what some people might argue is the better surgery in this context is something called the HoLEP, a holmium laser enucleation of the prostate. And again, the theory here is that if you can reduce any resistance to the outflow for the urine to flow, that might improve the bladder's ability to empty, especially when it doesn't seem that the bladder's muscle itself is able to push the urine out, which is what it's sounding like in his case if they said that the bladder can't build enough pressure. And historically, we used to think, well, if the bladder itself doesn't work and this muscle is kind of just this floppy bag and you're unable to build up pressure in the bladder and get the urine to come out, that even if you did prostate surgery, the odds are it's not going to help and you're still not going to be able to adequately empty. But in fact, there's actually a fair bit of evidence to suggest that at least with the HoLEP, that holmium laser surgery, patients whose bladders don't seem to work even on the urodynamics test can achieve benefits from doing the surgery to scrape out or use the laser to remove the bulky prostate tissue that's thought to be creating that resistance. Now, the risks are the risks of surgery. There's going to be a risk for bleeding that could sometimes require a secondary procedure or possibly a blood transfusion, a risk for infection, a urinary infection, a risk for scar tissue formation in the urethra or the passageway that itself could create a blockage, and even a risk for incontinence where you have trouble holding in the urine. But the good news is that for the majority of patients who do experience that incontinence after a surgery like that, it's transient and gradually seems to improve. And so you always have to weigh the benefits, the potential benefits against the risks. Now, there's no guarantee that the surgery is going to resolve everything, but it's definitely not unreasonable to consider it.
Our guest today, Dr. Michael Goralnik, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us today, located in Milwaukee, of course, as we talk bladder health with him. And you can join in. The number to call, we have open lines, get you on pretty quickly now, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick mention, at noon today, we'll talk about summer movies with a local film reviewer. And also coming up Thursday is our one-day member drive. And you don't have to wait till Thursday. You can donate right now. And it would help us out because there's a little incentive once we have, I forget the number now, a certain number of people phone in with a contribution. We have a bunch of donors who have gotten together, and we have $12,000 that'll be added right to the start if we have enough contributions or enough people contributing beforehand. So you can go to WPR.org/donate and make that contribution right now as you listen to our guest, Dr. Michael Goralnik, talking about achieving and maintaining a healthy bladder. And for that, you can call us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Tom emailed, can catheters help with BPH or overactive bladders?
So catheters are purely meant to help empty the bladder. It's basically bypassing the natural act of urination, and you use a catheter to insert into the urethra to get into the bladder to drain the bladder. So it doesn't actually treat BPH per se. It can deal with any urinary retention or inability to empty the bladder, but it's not actually treating the prostate per se. It's essentially trying to bypass the natural urination mechanism. As far as an overactive bladder goes, the catheter, again, doesn't treat anything as far as helping the bladder to hold the urine better. It's purely to help empty the bladder. Now, in some patients who might have an overactive bladder, some of the treatments that we might use, even sometimes medication, but specifically the using Botox, that can sometimes weaken the bladder to the point that it has trouble emptying. And then one might resort to catheterization to empty, and that allows you to continue with the treatment that's trying to improve the bladder's ability to hold in the urine, and then you're just using the catheter to get the urine out.
John wants to know, how often, if at all, is it normal to get up in the night to go to the bathroom?
Another great question. And again, the International Continence Society defines abnormal nighttime urination as waking up twice or more to go to the bathroom. So in truth, waking up once at night is actually normal. And actually, as one gets older, you might even argue even up to twice at night would not be unheard of or uncommon in somebody who's in their 70s, 80s, or 90s. Again, to some degree and to a major degree, it has a lot to do with how much urine is being produced. And there are some people who have a tendency to make an excessive amount of urine at night, even though it's not intentional. They're not necessarily drinking all night long. Their metabolism, in some cases, it can even be related to the lack of a certain hormone, or even entities such as sleep apnea, which is a notorious cause of excessive nighttime urination, or leg swelling that tends to worsen over the course of the day, and then you lie down at night and all that swelling goes away because all that fluid in the legs has now gotten back into the vascular system, and they start producing lots of urine at night, and that will contribute to having to wake up too many times to go. But that's because the bladder is potentially actually getting full at night and it has to go. That itself is not necessarily a bladder problem or even a prostate problem. It's a problem related to too much urine production, which you have to treat differently. Now, in some cases, there is an actual bladder dysfunction or a prostate issue such as benign prostate hyperplasia or BPH that's causing the nighttime urination, but those patients don't produce excessive amounts of urine. So technically, more than once a night is what's considered abnormal, but that can be for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. And I know I have some friends who hold back on water or fluids later in the day.
Sure.
Is that a reasonable thing for elderly, older people?
Yeah. we'll often recommend, you know, try not to drink very much after dinner, or, you know, really try to limit it. But unfortunately, as I said, in some cases, the body is retaining fluids throughout the day, and it's only once you go to bed at night that it actually starts coming out, especially in people with leg swelling. That's a notorious one. And so what we'll tell them to do is ideally you wear compressive stockings to try to minimize how much fluid accumulates in the legs. I'll even have patients try to take a late afternoon lie down and maybe put their legs under some pillows on the couch and watch the news or read something at around 4 or 5 o'clock with the hope of getting that fluid out of their legs earlier in the evening, being prepared that you're going to have to urinate when that happens. But the hope is that if you can get rid of that excess fluid earlier in the evening, then there's less of it to cause problems once you actually do go to bed at night. So it's a dilemma, and in many cases they're taking, you know, diuretics or water pills to help them get rid of the fluid, and inevitably they take it first thing in the morning because that's when it's the easiest time to take your medications and the time that you're going to be most likely to remember it. But of course, if they're taking that medicine to help get rid of that swelling, well, first thing in the morning is often when the leg swelling's at its best because they've spent the whole night supine and you don't have the effect of gravity pushing all the fluid into their legs. So it actually makes the least amount of sense to take your water pill first thing in the morning when your legs are at their best. So again, I'll tell them, take the water pill when you're about to have that late afternoon lie down to really encourage that fluid to get out of your system. But again, be prepared that, you know, following that lie down, which maybe you do it for a half an hour or an hour, you're probably going to have to go fairly often and potentially even in a bit of a hurry, but that might be a fair price to pay to allow you to sleep better at night.
Is there a connection, or maybe you could explain the connection, if there is one, between a healthy diet and a healthy bladder?
Well, our, you know, the diet's important for everything. And as far as the bladder goes, there are some classic dietary irritants that for, and it doesn't affect everybody the same way, but for some people, it's pretty typical. And the classic irritants for the bladder are things like alcohol, caffeine, spicy foods, acidy foods like citrus or tomatoes, and we don't necessarily know the exact mechanisms, but they seem to be more irritating for the bladder. And when people consume them, they can sometimes find that their bladder's more uncomfortable. In some cases, it can actually be outright painful. In other cases, they just feel that constant urge to urinate and maybe even have strong urgency. And so the general recommendation is to, you know, avoid such irritants. But what I tell patients to do is you have to figure it out for yourself, because again, not everybody responds the same way. So you choose whatever possible irritant that you might be consuming a fair bit of, and you get a baseline assessment of how their bladder's behaving while on it, and then you stop it for a week or two and then see how does your bladder behave when you've not been taking it. And if you can tell a big difference, well, then you've proved that maybe that's one that you should consider avoiding, unless the joy and pleasure that you get from consuming it outweighs any misery that your bladder might cause you. Just like I liken it to the smoker who doesn't like their cough but keeps on smoking. Well, you know, if you want to keep smoking, go for it, but then you can't complain, why am I coughing?
In the last minute, Carol emailed, are there any advancement in the treatment of interstitial cystitis at the recommendation of her urologist? She has had good success with a product named Preleaf.
So Preleaf is actually a supplement, so it's not a prescription medication, that helps to neutralize some of the acid in foods in the diet. And as I said, certain people, an interstitial cystitis, which is this basically a painful bladder condition that we don't really know what's the cause of it, and unfortunately there hasn't been a very good treatment for it. But if a patient knows that when they eat acidy foods, that really irritates their bladder, then something like Preleaf might allow them to cheat and continue eating said platter irritant of acidy food without getting the misery caused by it. So that's where Preleaf comes into play if acidy food is a big irritant for you. But it's not going to help the other types of irritants, you know, like caffeine or alcohol. So unfortunately, we don't have great options. In some cases, we will actually use painkillers or an antidepressant to help the discomfort from interstitial cystitis. We might even use treatments that go right into the bladder.
On that note, Dr. Guralnick, thank you so much for being with us. I hope we can do this again. Thank you very
much. Absolutely. My pleasure. Anytime.
Dr. Michael Guralnick, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And coming up, a look at the latest summer movies. I'm Larry Mueller.
Coming up